Chapter 31, Where the Brook and River Meet. Anne had a good summer and enjoyed it wholeheartedly. She and Diana fairly lived outdoors, revelling in all the delights that Lover's Lane and the Dryad's Bubble and Willowmere and Victoria Island afforded. Marilla offered no objections to Anne's gypsyings. The Spencerfield doctor who had come the night that Minnie May had the croup met Anne at the house of a patient one afternoon in early vacation. Looked her over sharply, screwed up his mouth, shook his head, and sent a message to Marilla Cuthbert by another person. It was, "Keep that redhead girl of yours out in the open air all summer, and don't let her read books until she gets more spring into her step." This message frightened Marilla wholesomely. She read Anne's death warrant by consumption in it unless it was scrupulously obeyed. As a result, Anne had the golden summer of her life as far as freedom and frolic went. She walked, rode, berried and dreamed to her heart's content, and when September came, she was bright-eyed and alert with a step that would have satisfied the Spencerfield doctor and a heart full of ambition and zest once more. "I feel like studying with might and main," she declared as she brought her books down from the attic. "Oh, you good old friends, I'm glad to see your honest faces once more. Yes, even you, geometry. I've had a perfectly beautiful summer, Marilla, and now I'm rejoicing as a strong man to run a race, as Mr. Allen said last Sunday." "Doesn't Mr. Allen preach magnificent sermons?" "Mrs. Lyne says he is improving every day, and the first thing we know, some city church will gobble him up, and then we'll be left to have to turn to and break into another green preacher. But I don't see the use of meeting trouble halfway. Do you, Marilla? I think it would be better just to enjoy Mr. Allen while we have him. If I were a man, I think I'd be a minister. They can have such an influence for good if their theology is sound. And it must be thrilling to preach splendid sermons and stir the hearers' hearts. Why can't women be ministers, Marilla? I asked Mrs. Lyne, and she was shocked and said it would be a scandalous thing. She said there might be female ministers in the States, and she believed there was. But thank goodness we hadn't gone to that stage in Canada yet, and she hoped we never would. But I don't see why. I think women would make splendid ministers. When there is a social to be got up, or a church tea, or anything else to raise money, the woman would have to do all the work. I'm sure Mrs. Lyde can pray every bit as well as Superintendent Bell, and I've no doubt she could preach too with a little practice." "Yes, I believe she could," said Marilla dryly. "She does plenty of unofficial preaching as it is. Nobody has much chance to go wrong in Avonlea and with Rachel to oversee them." "Marilla," said Anne with a burst of confidence, "I want to tell you something and ask you what you think about it. It has worried me terribly on Sunday afternoons, that is, when I think specifically about such matters. I really do want to be good, and when I'm with you, or Mrs. Allen, or Miss Stacy, I want it more than ever, and I want to do what would please you and what you would approve of. But mostly, when I'm with Mrs. Lyne, I feel desperately wicked, as if I wanted to go and do the very thing she tells me I oughtn't to do. I feel irresistibly tempted to do it. Now, what do you think is the reason I feel like that? Do you think it's because I'm really bad and unregenerate? Marilla looked dubious for a moment and then laughed. "If you are, I guess I am too. And for Rachel often has the very effect on me. I sometimes think she'd have more of an influence for good, as you say yourself, if she didn't keep nagging people to do right. There should have been a special commandment against nagging. But there, I shouldn't talk so. Rachel is a good Christian woman and she means well. There isn't a kinder soul in Avonlea, and she never shrinks her share of work. "I'm very glad you feel the same," said Anne decidedly. "It's encouraging. I shan't worry so much over that after this. But I dare say there'll be other things to worry me. They keep coming up new all the time. Things to perplex you, you know. You settle one question and then there's another right after. There are so many things to be thought over and decided when you're beginning to grow up. It keeps me busy all the time, thinking them over and deciding what is right. It's a serious thing to grow up, isn't it, Marilla? But when I have such good friends as you and Matthew and Mrs. Allen and Miss Stacy, I ought to grow up successfully, and I'm sure it will be my own fault if I don't. I feel it is a great responsibility because I have only the one chance. If I don't grow up right, I can't go back to the beginning over again. I've grown 2 inches this summer, Marilla. Mrs. Gillies measured me at Ruby's party, and I'm so glad you made my dress longer. That dark green one is so pretty, and it was sweet of you to put that flounce on it. Of course, I know it wasn't really necessary, but flounces are so stylish this fall. And Josie Pye has flounces all over her dress. I know I'll be able to study better because of mine. I have such a comfortable feeling deep down in my head about that flounce. It's worth something to have that, admitted Marilla. Miss Stacy came back to Avonlea School and found all her pupils eager to work once more. Especially did the Queen's class gird up their loins for the fray. At the end of the coming year, dimly shadowing their pathway ahead, loomed up the fateful thing known as the entrance, at the thought of which one and all felt their hearts sink into their very shoes. Suppose they did not pass? That thought was doomed to haunt Anne through the waking hours of the winter, Sunday afternoons inclusive to almost the entire exclusion of moral and theological problems. When Anne had bad dreams, she found herself staring miserably at past list of entrance exams, where Gilbert Blythe's name was blazoned at the top and in which hers did not appear at all. But it was jolly busy, happy, swift-flying winter. Schoolwork was as interesting. Class rivalry was absorbing as of yore. New words of thought, feelings and ambition, fresh fantasising fields of unexplored knowledge seemed to be opening out before Anne's eager eyes. Hills peeped over hills and Alps on Alps arose. Much of all that was due to Miss Stacy's tactful, careful, broad-minded guidance. She led her to class and explore and discover for themselves, to encourage straying from the old beaten paths to a degree that shocked Mrs. Lyde and the school's trustees, who viewed all innovations on established methods rather dubiously. Apart from her studies, Anne expanded socially. For Marilla, mindful of Spencerville doctor's dictum, no longer vetoed occasional outings. The debating club flourished and gave several concerts. There were one or two parties among almost verging on grown-up affairs, and there were sleigh drives and skating frolics galore. Between times, Anne grew, shooting up so rapidly that Marilla was astonished one day when they were side by side to find the girl was almost taller than herself. Why, Anne, how you've grown," she said, almost unbelievingly. A sigh followed on the words. Marilla felt a queer regret over Anne's inches. The child she had learned to love and vanished somehow, and here was this tall, serious-eyed girl of 15, with the thoughtful brows and the proudly poised little head in her place. Marilla loved the girl as much as she had loved the child, but she was conscious of a queer, sorrowful sense of loss. And that night, when Anne has gone to prayer meeting with Diana, Marilla sat alone in the wintry twilight and indulged in the weakness of a cry. Matthew, coming in with a lantern, caught her at it and gazed at her in such consternation that Marilla had to laugh through her tears. "I was thinking about Anne," she explained. "She's got to be such a big girl, and she'll probably be away from us next winter, and I'll miss her terrible." "She'll be able to come home often," comforted Matthew, to whom Anne was yet and always would be there, be the little eager girl he had brought home from Bright River on the June evening 4 years before. "The branch railroad will be built to Carmody by that time." "It won't be the same thing as having her here all the time," said Marilla gloomily, determined to enjoy the luxury of grief uncomforted. "But there, men can't understand these things." There were other changes in Anne, no less real than the physical change. For one thing, she became much quieter. Perhaps she thought all the more and dreamed as much as ever. But she certainly talked less. Marilla noticed and commented on this also. "You don't chatter half as much as you used to, Anne, nor use half as many big words. What has come over you?" Anne coloured and laughed a little as she dropped her book and looked dreamingly out of the window, where big fat red buds were bursting on the creeper in response to the lure of the spring sunshine. "I don't know. I don't want to talk as much," she said, denting her chin thoughtfully with her forefinger. "It's nicer to think, dear, pretty thoughts and keep them to one's heart, like treasures. I don't like to have them laughed at or wondered over, and somehow I don't want to use big words anymore. It's almost a pity, isn't it, now that I'm really growing big enough to say them if I didn't want to. It's fun to be almost grown up in some ways, but it's not the kind of fun I expected, Marilla. There's so much more to learn and to do and to think that there isn't time for big words. Besides, Miss Stacy says the short ones are much stronger and better. She makes us write all of our essays as simply as possible. It was hard at first. I was so used to crowding in all the fine big words I could think of, and I thought of any number of them. But I've got used to it now, and I see it so much better. What has become of your story club? I haven't heard you speak of it for a long time." "The story club isn't in existence any longer. We hadn't time for it, and anyhow, I think we got tired of it. It was silly to be writing about love and murder and elopements and mysteries. Miss Stacy sometimes had us write a story for training in composition, but she won't let us write anything but what might happen in Avonlea in our own lives. And she criticises it sharply, making us criticise our own too. I never thought my compositions had so many faults until I began to look for them myself. I felt so ashamed, I wanted to give up altogether, but Miss Stacy said I could learn to write well if I only trained myself to be my own severest critic, and I'm trying to." "You've only got 2 more months before the entrance," said Marilla. "Do you think you'll be able to get through?" Anne shivered. "I don't know. Sometimes I think I'll be all right, and then I get horribly afraid. We've studied hard and Miss Stacy has drilled us thoroughly, but we mayn't get through all that. We've each got a stumbling block. Mine is geometry, of course, and Jane's is Latin, and Ruby and Charlie's is algebra, and Josie's is arithmetic. Moody Spurgeon says he feels it in his bones that he is going to fail in English history,